Welcome to The Convex Conversation, a brand new podcast series with me, broadcaster Helen Prospero. Today I'm chatting to Stephen Catlin, chairman and CEO of Convex Group. In his own words, Stephen fell into Lloyd's of London at the age of 19, having promised his father he'd follow in his footsteps and study medicine. It was 1973, Tie Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree was topping the charts, and a chance conversation with a sailing friend who needed a boy in his box at Lloyd's led to an interview. Stephen duly cut his shoulder-length hair, donned his bright blue suit, yellow shirt complete with huge collar, kipper tie and brown shoes with stacked heels. Unsure of the difference at that stage between Lloyd's Bank and Lloyd's of London, Stephen got the job, and the rest, as they say, is history. Stephen formed a tiny insurance underwriting agency at Lloyd's before he turned 30, and 31 years later sold it for more than $4 billion. And he's doing it all again. Stephen, thanks very much for making time in your day to speak to me today. I absolutely love chapter 9 of your book entitled Beginnings, which that story comes from. How do you look back on those days?
Thank you for spending the time with me too. Helen, it's a long while ago now. It's getting close to 50 years ago, so memories do fade. But I basically had lost my way as a teenager. I had a good time, but I didn't study. And the reason I didn't study was I didn't like academia at the time. I actually quite like it now. And because my father was pushing me in a direction I didn't want to go, so I rebelled. As a consequence, didn't put any effort into schooling from the age of probably about 12 or 13 all the way through. And it's only when I failed my A-levels the first time that I realised maybe I will get my finger out and do something and make a difference. And I don't think I really got my mind around what life's about till I started at Lloyd's. And as you correctly have pointed out, I landed up in Lloyd's by mistake. Now, in those days, that wasn't uncommon. A lot of my peer group will tell you that they landed up there by mistake.
And as a 19-year-old, it sounds like you had a whole raft of job ideas up your sleeve before literally falling into insurance.
Yeah, I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to go to a red brick university, I'm sure of that. And I didn't want to do academia for the hell of it, I'm sure of that. But I looked into the police force, I looked into the services, I considered going down some mechanical route. And then this suddenly came up. And I can remember my mother saying to me, "You must be mad. You hate being indoors the whole time. You're never going to enjoy it." Well, I could see what she was saying. And I do like being outside. I'd spend a lot of my time when not in the office outside. But actually, until you get involved in a marketplace like Lloyd's and enjoy the community spirit and the challenge, you don't really understand what it's all about.
I'm curious, Stephen, to hear a little bit about your upbringing and your parents and what your childhood was like.
Well, my only claim to fame, I think, is that the Queen's gynecologist held my mum's hand as I popped out the other end. So that's my first experience of any form of notoriety. My father was in the army, and he stayed in the army right the way through until I was about 4 and a half. And I think we moved houses 11 times in that period of time. He got posted abroad twice, but never went. And then he settled down into a family practice GP in Chelmsford in Essex. And essentially, I grew up there. Went to prep school, was going to go to a minor public school, and then my brother turned up somewhat unexpectedly, and the money couldn't stretch to having what was then 4 children in the public school system. So a decision was taken that wasn't going to happen to any of us. So at the age of 10 and a half, I was told I wasn't going to public school, and I had to do my 11 plus. Well, if you're in a prep school working towards common entrance, you have actually no training whatsoever for 11 plus. So guess what? I failed it. And I then did a reset, and I got passed. But the decision had been taken by the council of the time that all the people who resat their 11 plus and passed would go to a comprehensive school. Now, this was a brand new school. I was top of the year every year I was there. It had all walks of life there. I had to change how I spoke because I got beaten up a couple of times because I had a prep school accent. And I learned the hard way about how life really is in the real world. At the time, I wasn't resentful, disappointed that I hadn't been to public school. But, you know, as time's gone on, I realise I learned a hell of a lot during my teenage years, albeit not academically. but I did learn about people and backgrounds. It was a co-ed school. I had a lot of life experiences going on, coming from what was a fairly protected environment.
Apart from being beaten up now and again, do you look back on them as happy days, Stephen?
Yes, I do, funnily enough. It was fun. I have to say I haven't kept in contact with any of those people nowadays, but I had some quite good friends at school, and we had some laughs, absolutely.
And how did your parents feel about you not going into the medical world, becoming a doctor or a dentist? Were they supportive of your new adventure into Lloyd's?
Well, my father was absolutely furious failing my A-levels. I had to go over to France on holiday to meet my parents. On both occasions, I had to tell them I hadn't got... Well, the first time I had said I failed my A-levels, and the second time I had to say I hadn't got the grades I needed. Now, I'd been exceptionally lucky because I'd been offered an average of 3 Ds to go into dentistry the first year, and then on the second year, I was offered an average of 3 Cs, both by London and Guy's. They weren't actually high targets, but, you know, my heart wasn't in it. I wasn't interested, really. My father was livid and thought that I absolutely had to have a degree and I should go into a profession. That's the only decent thing to do. And I just refused. I think before I set up Catlin, but not much before, my father had accepted that I was actually achieving something. But he didn't really recognise it in any shape or form until I was 40 plus. And he never did to me personally. He just told my friends.
Gosh, that must have been... Yeah, such is life, but fairly hard, I would have thought. Take me back, if you can, Stephen, to day one, when you became a boy in a box at Lloyd's. I mean, it was very different looking, wasn't it, to how it is now in your company. What was that room like?
Oh, it's bizarre. It was a little bit like going back to prep school, actually. There's a man on our box called Norman Poole, affectionately known as Puddle. He was a retired person working on a retainer who taught me a lot. And he used to take me on side and say, Stephen, you've got 2 eyes, 2 ears and 1 tongue. Use them proportionally. I've never forgotten that.
Solid advice, I would have thought.
Yeah, I say it to people in the firm today when I see somebody talking too much and who's got the transmit button on as opposed to the receive button, I will quote him.
So in those early days, did you get quite stuck in and realise that you were really liking this new world that you'd entered without any sort of planning to go into that kind of business?
No, I nearly left twice in the first 3 years, but I just couldn't get my mind around it. There seemed to be no rationale to how things were priced, and it was dead man's shoes. And whilst it had a prep school type environment, it was difficult to take it, I felt, seriously. This is going to sound terribly arrogant, and I apologise, but it was about after 3 or 4 years, I looked around and I thought, blimey, if those guys can get on in this market, I'm sure I can. And I think once I made my mind up, which was about 3 years in, I think 4, I can't remember now, at that point I became super determined to achieve.
And was it at that point when you became super determined to achieve that you thought about starting your own small syndicate and moving away from the bigger area of Lloyd's of London?
No, what actually happened, the thing called divestment. A holding company could not own a Lloyd's broker and a Lloyd's managing agency, that's the underwriter, together on the basis that it was a conflict of interest because a certain company had not honoured that conflict. So we were up for sale. And I suddenly realised that I was a pawn in the rich man's game and I would have absolutely no impact on the outcome whatsoever. I thought we'd be bought by either Sturge or Merritt, were two large managing agencies at the time. And my money was on Merritt. We set up in the end of 84. 85, the company I worked for was sold to Merritt, as I predicted. 9 months after we came on our own. And just to complete that story, come 1992, I then bought back from Merritt the sister syndicate, the non-marine syndicate of my old firm, and I paid £1 for it. And I also paid, as earned, half of the agency fees for 2 years and half of the profit commission. And the reason that happened was because Merritt was going bust. And in fact, it was my banker who said to me, would you like to take this on for us? Because it could be a problem. And I knew what was in there. It had an open year. It was the best transaction acquisition I've ever done in my life. And I can remember sitting in our boardroom table about 4:30 in the afternoon. I gave them a glass of champagne. And I said to them, which they never had before in office hours. And I said, you're in for a culture shock. You're in for change. And they said, we like change, Stephen. I don't think they quite understood what I meant by change.
And what did you mean by change?
Well, if I tell you that the claims ledger was still entered in pencil so they could rub it out and change it if they wanted to, Maybe that gives you a clue.
Certainly does. And were there some restless and sleepless nights during those early days?
Yeah, I mean, the first 10 years, I was earning a lot less than my peers in the marketplace, probably about two-thirds of what they're earning. I was pretty close to the breadline, a wife and two kids and a decent-sized mortgage. Two or three things happened in that first 10 years that nearly tipped us over. And it wasn't until about the 10th year that I felt, you know what, I've got my head above water. Now we can start not relaxing, but maybe we can sort of feel safe and we can start really pushing the business forward. But that first 10 years, I think if I known how bad and difficult that was, maybe I wouldn't have done it. It was quite stressful.
How was Helen, your wife, through that period, Stephen? How much of a support and a rock was she to you when you were at times, as you say, close to the breadline?
She was fantastic, always has been. I mean, she acted as my PA and secretary when we started. She would help me write the end of report and accounts, press articles. She knew everybody in the firm, wasn't particularly interested in insurance per se, but was interested in the people. I mean, I suspect the best way of describing her is on 9/11, I was in Houston, strange enough, having a strategic meeting about the future of our US business, which didn't go that well, as it happens, with what was going on. I eventually got hold of Helen about 4 hours later, because we were literally driving into the office as the second plane went in. It was that immediate. And I eventually got hold of her, and she said, "How's it going?" I said, "Fine." I said, "How are you?" "Fine." When something like that happens and you're separated, you tend to really feel it. So there's kind of a relief just to communicate. And then she said, "Are you all right?" I said, "Absolutely fine. What about the business?" I said, "I don't know. I have no idea. I think we're okay, but I can't answer that question truthfully at this stage. Hopefully by the end of the week I can." And she said, "Stephen, you know what? We start in a two up, two down. If we have to go back to that, that's fine by me." Without any hesitation whatsoever. And I think that's pretty substantial support from your wife.
That's a wonderful thing to say. I mean, did you ever think as a 19-year-old contemplating life, making clotted cream and taking apart your Morris Minor and rebuilding it, that you'd go on to build and create something? I mean, Catlin Group, a multi-billion pound company, 2,500 employees, and it started out just two of you, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I had absolutely no comprehension whatsoever, actually, at the get-go. My financial ambitions was to own the house unencumbered and to have money put away to pay for the school fees. And that was the extent of my financial aspirations. And I certainly didn't believe that we could do what we did. Funny enough, 9/11 was a fulcrum for us. When 9/11 happened, I realized that there was a massive opportunity there if one had extra capital. And we spent 9 months working hard to raise capital. We raised $500 million, which is by a country mile bigger than anybody else in London. It was hard, mainly because half the time I having to explain Lloyd's and why it wasn't going to go under, as opposed to what we could do going forward. But we got there from being a sort of a mid-sized syndicate. Within 2 years, we were the same size as the bigger syndicates. And then we made an acquisition of Wellington in 2006, having done an IPO in 2004. And by that stage, we were then the largest syndicate in Lloyd's. And we stayed that way until the sale to XL. And I guess it's around that time that I began to realize actually we could really build something quite special and we could actually build a global business, which is something I never dreamt of. In fact, I've learned not to say never because it always bites me afterwards, but I said I'd never go public. And the reason I said that was I didn't believe we could ever, ever have a market cap approaching £1 billion. And as you said earlier, actually when we sold, it was $4.3 billion. So that was beyond my wildest dreams. But it evolved. And the whole thing happened because of the people in Catlin, actually. I'll put my hand up and say, yeah, I was team leader. But that's as far as it goes. You know, it happened because of the group of people that trusted each other, liked each other, challenged each other on a regular basis, and worked together. That's what made it happen. And that team took some time to build. But once we had it, we kept it. The team, that is.
You've been quoted as saying that there are many reasons for Catelyn's success as a company, but the biggest factor was Catelyn culture. What were and are the ingredients, Stephen, for Catelyn culture?
I think it was based on a fundamental belief I had that you treat people fairly and with respect and dignity, you know, both inside the firm and outside of the firm, both up the line, across the line and down the line. And that's sort of, I guess that's a value I got from going to a mixed comprehensive school and watching and observing what was going on around me and saying, right, there is a different way. After about 10 years or so, maybe a bit more, I got a consultant in. I don't really like using consultants, if I'm truthful, but I got a consultant in to find out whether the next layer down in Catelyn, beneath senior management, had the same values that we had. And I knew if I tried to do that research myself, I wouldn't get to the truth. Nobody was going to tell me what they really thought. So it was appropriate, I thought, to have somebody come in. And the person came in, and I think he interviewed about 50 people. And he came up to me afterwards, he said, "Stephen, this has been a unique experience for me. It's not unique, but it is to me." So I say, "Why is that?" He said, "Because everybody I've spoken to is on the same side of the page. But," and of course, that's what you're paying for, is the but bit, not the first bit. "But when I asked them to describe the brand and the culture of Catelyn, after about 20 minutes or half an hour, they've told me. And they all use different words, but the end result is just the same. Why don't you think about how you can describe your brand, your culture, simply, so that everybody can use the same expressions?" I'm sitting there thinking, I should have been able to spot that myself. I've spent all this money on a consultant. He told me something which is, frankly, when he said it, was blindingly obvious. So I said, "Yes, great, thank you very much, very helpful." So I went to the next group executive meeting, and I thought, right, we'll have a session on brand and values. And I thought, well, it'll take about 2 hours. Well, after 2 hours, it became very clear to all of us that the way we were describing things, whilst directionally the same, wasn't identical. And people were starting to have quite strong feelings about how they felt. Having spent 2 hours a month, we actually got to 5 words that described what we were. It was transparency, accountability, teamwork, integrity, and dealing with people with dignity. And we got there, and everybody signed up to it. We were very happy. We were very loath, I in particular was very loath to talk about it externally, until I was certain that we were actually not talking the talk, but walking the walk. I wanted to be certain that we were living our values. Because in those days, people didn't talk about culture, actually, in the way we do today. I mean, it's almost a given now that a decent firm has a culture which they talk about and they express and then try and live. But it was somewhat revolutionary at the time. But what we found, and I still find today, actually, is if you create an environment where people can work together, they can be transparent, they can trust each other, they can share, and they behave properly with other people in the firm and outside of the firm, whatever level they are. I mean, I can never believe why a person would walk in the office and walk straight past a receptionist and never acknowledge that they're there. I mean, how rude is that? That feeling of being part of an extended family means that people want to be there. I'm passionate about the culture being the drivers of a successful business.
And manners too, Stephen. I mean, it costs nothing to say thank you and to show some appreciation. And that's been very important throughout your journey too, hasn't it?
Yeah, I've always said about bringing up children, the 4 things you need to teach them: please, thank you, and sorry, and the value of money. And if they learn all those 4 things, they're set. And you know what? That applies to the company. If people say please, they say thank you, they're prepared to put their hand up and acknowledge and make a mistake, and they don't take for granted the business, we have something which is different, which is special.
I'm sure throughout your career so far, you've made mistakes. I just wonder how you handle mistakes and how you cope with them, how you deal with them.
I certainly have made mistakes. To be honest with you, you learn much more by the mistakes you make than by getting things right. And some of the mistakes I've made in the past, I'm absolutely horrified by. Having made a mistake, the first thing that is required is self-appraisal. I'm just going to tell you a story to underscore that. So Graham Hearn, at the time of our first private equity raise, who had been summoned to New York and had sat at his lawyer's office twice in 7 weeks. It was not a pleasant experience, either one. On the second occasion, I had just about had enough and said, life's too short, I'll do something else. I'm sure people will come with me. And suddenly from nowhere, Sir Graham just threw his toys out of the pram and went ballistic. And it was like being in a 10-pin bowling alley. One by one, they all rolled over on their backs like skittles, having been knocked down by the ball. And we went down in the lift. I actually hugged him and said, I can't thank you enough. He said, well, that wasn't too bad, Stephen, was it? You know, I think we got somewhere. We got into the limo waiting for us to go take us back to the airport. And I sat on the left-hand side. And he got his left hand, he put it on my right hand arm and said, Stephen, I could have done that better. And I looked at him, I thought, where's he coming from? Because I thought he was an absolute superstar. And he said, you know what? I could have achieved that without causing collateral damage. I didn't need to have done it that way. And I thought to myself, my God, he's just won a battle, if not the war, against all the odds. And the first thing you do is have self-appraisal. The second thing you do is you communicate it. And the third thing you do is you say why and how you made a mistake. At that stage, he was 69. And I thought to myself, if you can do that at that age, I can certainly do it at my age. And I've used that story time and time again and said, look, if you've made a mistake, you have to recognize it internally. The second thing is you need to admit to it externally. The third thing is you need to work out why you made the mistake. Fourthly, how you made the mistake. Fifthly, how do I make certain I don't make that mistake again? I don't know anybody who's been successful in business. I don't know any CEO who's been successful who hasn't made mistakes. And all the ones that I regard to be successful are the type of people that do go through self-appraisal, do learn, and do behave differently. If a CEO is a leader, you can show humility. And to people who work for you, I'm sorry, I got that wrong. That's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength.
So in 2015, you sold Catlin, the company you'd built right from the ground up. Why did you sell the company you founded and you lived and breathed for more than 30 years?
In a sense, you know, we are almost a victim of our own success. But we hit a brick wall and there was no obvious way of going round it, under it or over it. And when you're a public company, you know, your first priority is to your shareholder and create shareholder value. And in fact, I can remember the last board meeting when we decided we were going to do this, which was literally days before the thing was agreed. And one of the independent directors said to me, you realise, Stephen, that if you go through with this transaction, you will be spat out within 6 months. And I said to him, I said, look, I do understand what you're saying. I certainly accept it as being a probability. Based on the conversation I had, I'm not certain it's a probability. But that aside, this is not about me now. It's about shareholder value. And if I have to fall on my sword, then that's what I have to do. And I was wrong. He was right about me being spat out, actually. But I wasn't wrong about shareholder value. And three or four other directors all said, Stephen, that is absolutely the right thing to say. We never thought you'd say it. Good for you. On the back of that statement from me, we made our minds up fairly quickly that the best thing to do for shareholders was to sell. It wasn't an easy decision for me. It was not a very difficult emotionally. It isn't emotionally what I wanted to do. And I can still get watery-eyed even thinking about it now.
I know it was tearful and emotionally draining on the last day of Catlin's existence as an independent company before the merger. I mean, it's been such a personal company for you, bears your name. You started it from just a little seed. But it hit you the hardest the day after, didn't it, when you started opening some of the emails from your employees?
Yeah, two things happened. I was in Bermuda when it actually happened. So by the time I'd woken up, with London being 4 hours ahead, people had time to write emails to me. And I got about 47 in the space of about 2 hours. And I read the first two and I thought, oh, that's rather nice, isn't it? By the time I got to the 47th, I was actually driven wreck, really emotional. In fact, I had to get myself together for 2 hours before I could go into the office. I was so emotionally distressed. Frankly, flabbergasted by the things people said. I had no idea of the depths of feeling. And when it's just confronted with just like that, it was moving, humbling, and yeah, very emotional.
I've loved many of your stories that you've told today, Stephen. One thing that struck me was the words that Helen said to you when she said, you know, if everything went wrong, she'd just be happy in a two up, two down. How has wealth changed you? Do you care about money? Obviously, it gives you perhaps a more luxurious life, but are you bothered about that kind of thing?
Is it a privilege to have money? Yes. I don't spend capital. I might redeploy capital. I mean, I own quite a lot of property around the place, but I can touch it, I can feel it, I can see it. The trouble with an insurance business is there's a piece of paper called a balance sheet, and that's it. Whereas if you've got a property, you can walk around it, you can feel it. A reaction of mine against having a balance sheet as what I've created as opposed to a real thing.
And I'm guessing these days you own more than two suits.
Yeah, I do actually. I mean, I was at one point during Captains, I was spending 75% of the time on the road, and I actually had permanent dwellings in about five different cities around the world. So whenever I went shopping, I would buy five pairs of shoes, five suits, whatever, all the same, just so I could park them in all the places I lived. I just knew that I had everything I wanted wherever I was. The trick of that is to make certain when you turn up at a place, you leave that place with the same clothes you wore when you turned up. Otherwise, you suddenly find you've got all your clothes in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Didn't your mum help you out when you just had the two? I think you had a dull green one and a blue one at one point.
Yeah, well, I said I needed a new suit. Could I borrow some money? She said, you don't need a new suit. You've got two perfectly good suits. I said, well, yeah, I can't because that one's green. And she said, well, what's wrong with that? I said, well, everybody think I'm a claims broker if I wear a green suit. No idea of that kind of protocol whatsoever, and didn't care about it either, frankly. No, I'm a boring old fart, I think. I just buy the same clothes I was buying 30, 40 years ago.
Not the stacked heels and the kipper tie, I hope.
No, I don't do the kipper tie. I do, actually. I'm going to own up. I do have some cowboy boots with stacked heels.
And when you're not working, Stephen, I know you're probably 24/7, really, in your working life, but how do you unwind and relax?
Well, I think family life is a different challenge, and it's change, and therefore in itself is relaxing from the day-to-day work. People used to say to me, well, you never see your family. I said, no, that's not true, actually. I make certain that once a month we meet for Sunday lunch, and if I say I'm going to be at home, everybody wants to meet up and makes an effort, and it happens. I like field sports. I used to ski, but my legs have given up on me, so I've had to pack that in. I like to shoot, I like to fish. I've got land up north, and some people say this is a non sequitur, but actually I'm a conservationist. I believe that if you own land, you don't really own it. You have it lent to you, and you have a duty of care to leave the land in a better condition than when you've received it. And if you look at life that way, it drives you to do certain things. I mean, I bought some moors 23 years ago, which were completely run down, and flora and fauna was not in abundance. If you go there today, after careful keepering, we have no end of species of birds, which things that you'd never see when I first bought them nearly 25 years ago. And that is tremendously rewarding, actually. I might love being outside, I might love being in the countryside. So to me, yeah, I run it as a business, but it's a hobby as well.
Convex was born with a silver spoon, if you like, in its mouth next to Catlin. Millions of pounds worth of investment from day one. What drove you to start again?
I kind of felt this was an unfinished business. I thought I was going to be able to finish off an XL Catlin, but it didn't happen. A lot of people would come up to me in the street, and indeed to Brando, sometimes separately, sometimes collectively, and said, for God's sake, get back in the market. It needs some leadership. We need you back. And when one person says that to you, doesn't know it. When you've got about 10 different people saying the same thing to you from slightly different walks of life, you say, well, okay, there's a consistency here. Maybe there is one opportunity.
You have the most stunning offices for Convex with the most spectacular views over the capital. When you stand, as I've seen you do, at the edge of that glass and you're looking out over those extraordinary views, do you pinch yourself sometimes, Stephen?
Every time, without exception. I was talking to Brandon about it the other day, and I said, do you pinch yourself when you wake up in the morning? He said, yes, I do. We both recognise that we are exceptionally fortunate. We've had the stars come into line together twice in our careers, and that often doesn't happen once for people. And I look out of that window, as you say, it's an exceptional view, and I just think, how lucky am I?
I'm not going to take any more of your time. I could chat away all day to you. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time and joining us on this podcast that we're recording specially for Convex. So thank you very much indeed. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, I can't thank you enough. It's really nice to have somebody asking the questions who I feel is a kindred spirit, who actually understands properly the emotions that one goes through.
That was Stephen Catlin, CEO and chairman of Convex, sharing stories from his upbringing and personal life and giving us an insight into his extraordinary accidental journey to the top of the insurance world. Stephen and I chatted in more depth about the unexpected emotional lows he experienced when he sold Catlin. I'll bring that to you in a special second part. I hope you're enjoying our Convex conversations. Please feel free to share them with friends and family. Convex.podbean.com is the link, or go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts. I'll be back next week. Until then, keep safe and thanks for listening.